This week we're just going to talk about the last years of Spurgeon's life, and then next week we're going to just talk about his impact. So one thing I wanted to do is give everyone the opportunity to just talk about how studying Spurgeon's impacted you. So feel, you know, we'll open up for that, and then we'll just talk a little bit about just his impact on just kind of the aftermath of his ministry and life and everything else. But that'd be a good opportunity for us to have a discussion. We do have a business meeting next week at 5:45. So if I'm not down here at 5:45 or 6, don't panic. I'm down in the fellowship hall business meeting. So we may run a little late, but that's our last week. And intentionally, I kind of left it a little shorter. There's not as much to cover next week. But I'd like for us to discuss as much as everybody would like to next week. So the book that we've been reading is this Child is the Father of the Man by Tom Nettles, which is an abridged version of his huge sort of magnum opus biography in a lot of ways of Spurgeon. Nettles is the only biography I know of that it's unique in two ways. And so what you've got, the material here has been unique in two ways, I think. One, it's really looking at his pastoral theology. It's really studying him through the lens of his approach, his theological approach to pastoring. But the second thing is the source material that Nettles used was unique in that he spent a lot of time in Spurgeon's magazine. It's not readily available, called The Sword and the Trowel. So there's a lot of original source material in Nettles' work that's not out there in a lot of things. So it's unique in that. You know, at this point, you write a biography on Spurgeon, you've got to have it's like writing a biography on Churchill. I mean, you have to have a reason why you're some sort of source material or something to justify your biography. And so the latest two that I've found of interest that add something, I think, to the conversation on Spurgeon, but Nettles, and then another one by Thomas Braemeyer that I found really interesting, called Tethered to the Cross. And it was just a look at a focus on the cross and a focus on conversion in the teaching and preaching and writing of Spurgeon. That was a really helpful little book. You know, so that's adding something. It's a unique addition. Okay, anyway, does anybody have any thoughts or questions from the reading so far? Ted, you might have several. None at all. I thought you'd have a few stacked up, Ted. Come on. All right. Any thoughts or questions or anything from the reading so far? You only have two more weeks to do that, guys. I just knew Ted would have some fuel stacked up for us for some fodder. I hate that. Any questions or thoughts from anything we've talked about so far? Anything? All right. Well, tonight we'll talk about two things, the last years of Spurgeon's life, but also we talked a little bit about, we'd like some folks to mention, I think it was Gloria, and she's not able to be here, but anyway, wanting to know a little more about Susanna Spurgeon, Spurgeon's wife, and a little more about their marriage and things like that. So we'll talk about that a little bit, and then we'll transition to his later years. Feel free to interrupt me at any time, you know, if you've got a question or something you want to talk about. One of the reasons why I wanted to study Spurgeon is his life and the times in which he lived are a lens through which we can kind of view a lot of modern issues. So if anything jumps out at you or whatever, I'd love to talk about it. So Spurgeon met his wife, Susanna Spurgeon. She went to the church he pastored. So there's a few kind of funny little things from early in his ministry. There's one where he's calling out the new members of the church, and the young women in the church kind of wanted Spurgeon's attention as well. He was 19 years old when he went there, and so he was kind of a little bit of a heartthrob. You know, everybody was kind of interested because he was single, and the church is exploding with growth, and so everybody's kind of interested in Spurgeon. So there's a little anecdote in one of the books I read where he's calling out the new members of the church and they're running the roll, and somebody's name's John Deere. Which is kind of funny now that I think about it. But anyway, John Deere. And then one young woman says to the other, says, "What name did he say?" And he said, "John Deere." She said, "Well, I'm sure the next will be Susanna Deere." You know, and that wasn't her name, but they were jealous of his affection for his soon-to-be wife, Susanna. She was called Susie Spurgeon in different times. One huge part of Susanna Spurgeon's life, the main focus of her life was supporting her husband's ministry. They had a little tiff when they were dating. And as I read about this, I was like, man, I know this feeling. Spurgeon had gone somewhere to preach, and she went with him. He has a big to-do, and she went with him. And at some point or another, he got whisked away and just kind of left her behind, you know. And so she just went home, and she just got out of there. And she got home, and her mother said, "Why are you here back so early?" And she said, "Well, he just met up with some deacons and was about to go preach and just left me behind, you know." And so her mother kind of got onto her a little bit and said, "Honey, you know, he's called. You can't expect him to value you higher than the Lord," or whatever. Now, I will say, I don't like that excuse very much, you know. Like, you don't have to choose 99% of the time. But I think you get a sense. I don't know if you've ever been around someone who's just brilliant. And the other thing I'll say, not that I'm brilliant, but I preach. And when it's time to preach, it's time to preach, you know. And it's, you kind of get a singular focus. And one of the most, it's important, I think, to recognize that when a pastor's getting ready to preach, I mean, he's really in another world. And I don't know if y'all know this about me, I get in another world a lot. I live in another world sometimes. In fact, just the other day, I'm not comparing myself to Spurgeon, but I'm just talking about, I had a lot on my mind leaving work, just things, just nothing bad, just the budget and a couple other things that I was just kind of thinking about. And I pulled up, apparently, right in front of the fire hall at the red light, I pulled up next to Jared Luck, who's a great friend, you know, and usually if I see you in town, I'm like, you know, that's kind of what I do. And Jared said, I looked at him and then turned back around and never said, and I have no recollection at all of seeing Jared at all. I was in the zone, you know. Well, it's like that with preaching. So I think that's what happened with Spurgeon. He just kind of was in the zone. He's getting ready to preach and his mind's on other things. He forgot. It just, you know, it just happened. And so focused on this. And so he came back. Running back to the house after he got done preaching when he realized she wasn't there and apologized profusely. And then she apologized and said, I was being selfish. And so she talks about in her memoirs and what she talks about how that was a key moment for her in God solidifying her call to support this great ministry that Spurgeon had. They did have two sons, twin boys, I think. I think they were twins. Yeah, twin boys. One of whom went on to be the pastor after Spurgeon at Metropolitan Tabernacle, Thomas Spurgeon. Much like Charles, Susanna had severe health issues. She spent the majority of her adult life as a semi-invalid, so adding to all Spurgeon's own health problems and challenges and the stress of his ministry and everything else, he also had his wife, who he had to help care for as well, who had very serious health issues. But she did, over time, develop her own ministry. After Spurgeon's book, Lectures to My Students, was released, and I've read from that some. Is everybody warm enough? Okay. That's better. All right. I didn't turn the air on. I just turned the heat down, okay, guys? So I hope everybody's okay with that. For those of you who are listening at home, I got a little warm and turned the air down. All right. Sorry for the break there. So Lectures to My Students is a collection of lectures that Spurgeon taught in the pastor's college. And Spurgeon came home one day, and she had read the book, and she said, I wish I could give one of these to every pastor. And, you know, every pastor. And Spurgeon said, well, why don't you? You know, go for it. What would it take? Where could we find the money for it? And she remembered she had a little bit of savings that she had been saving up over time. Every nickel or something she had saved and saved up enough. And it was just enough to buy 100 copies of the book and send to needy pastors. So she started there. And even though she never, you know, these kind of things happen, she wouldn't let Spurgeon tell people she was doing it. And I'm guessing he didn't listen. But nonetheless, money started coming in for her to do that for other pastors. And over time, this grew into a huge book ministry where she would send her husband's books to needy pastors all over the place. Well, as word got out that they were doing that, they would get letters back from other needy pastors, other needy areas. It's kind of interesting. There's a, even in Wales, just in terms of British religious history, is kind of interesting. You don't understand typically Methodists to be Calvinistic, but there was a Welsh Calvinist Methodist church, group of churches in Wales, and so they sent a lot there. If you're familiar at all with Martin Lloyd-Jones, he came out of that tradition, the Welsh Methodist Catholic, Calvinist tradition. Anyway, hey, Whit. And, man, what a beautiful sound. Isn't that wonderful, guys? I love it. So nonetheless, you start sending all this. So it grew into this huge, large ministry. People are giving money like crazy to it without them even really asking. And then more money and more requests kept coming in for books. Well, then over time, she would also hear about how she would get letters back from the pastors who got the books, and they would just tell her in general just what their living conditions were like. You know, they're just poor people in ministry. And she began to get a heart for that, and she developed what came to be known as a pastor's aid fund. And she and people gave to that, and they wound up helping pastors financially as well. And these are all things that Susie Spurgeon really, really worked on. So she's semi-invalid, had to be home. She has this husband who's doing great things, but she had her own ministry, and it gave her a real sense of satisfaction that she was able to do that. In fact, let me just read to you a little bit here. This is Arnold Dallimore.
Did they have children?
They did. They had two sons. Yeah, Thomas and John, I think. Yeah, and Thomas went on to be the pastor at the Tabernacle. He was one of Spurgeon's successors. Let me see if I'm... Okay. Spurgeon speaks about his wife's ministry. Here's what he says. I gratefully adore the goodness of our Heavenly Father in directing my beloved wife to a work which has been to her fruitful in unutterable happiness. That it has cost her more pain than it would be fitting to reveal is most true, but that it has brought her boundless joy is equally certain. Our gracious Lord ministered to his suffering child in the most effectual manner when he graciously led her to minister to the necessities of his service. By this means, he called her away from her personal grief, that's her personal grief in losing her health, gave tone and concentration to her life, led her to continual dealings with himself, and raised her nearer the center of that region where other than earthly joys and sorrows reigned supreme. Let every believer accept this as the inference of experience that for most human maladies, the best relief and antidote will be found in self-sacrificing work for the Lord Jesus. Then he's saying that about his own wife. Here's something she says about her ministry. I am personally indebted to the dear friends who have furnished me with the means of making others happy. For me, there has been a double blessing. I've been both recipient and donor. My days have been made indescribably bright and happy by the delightful duties connected with the work and its little arrangements. That I seem to be living in an atmosphere of blessing and love, and can truly say with the psalmist, my cup runneth over. So again, you can see the way that just this small ministry that she had, despite her physical ailments and maladies, gave her a lot of joy. And I love the way, though, that you can see Spurgeon could have become a very rich man. Through all the book sales, and same with Susanna, but almost all the money and all the extra money they would have received. And that's not to say that they lived, he didn't die rich by any means. He died having given most of his money away. But they did live well. They didn't live in destitution or poverty or anything like that. So they were well taken care of, but he didn't use his position to grow wealth necessarily. He used it to further the ministry. And there's something to be said about that. I'll just say a little about, I'll just say there's a difference between someone, for example, who uses ministry to get rich, and then someone who uses their ministry to spread the gospel. So I'm most impressed with authors. Now, again, you write a book and you sell the book. You're entitled to this work you've done. You're entitled to those royalties. But I'm really impressed with the pastors and ministers who use book royalties to try to spread the gospel out. You know, I'm most impressed with that. So not to say they don't get anything from it, but I'm most impressed with that. And I'm least impressed with people. And usually the ones who write about the gospel are the ones who give it away and give as much away, and the ones who write about getting rich are the ones that get rich, you know? And I'll leave it at that before I get angry. But I love the way Spurgeon used his influence and wealth. And I love the way his wife, instead of just sitting there and kind of moping, which would be easy to do, nobody would blame her for it, decided to get busy helping others. And it just shows you a lot about the heart of the Spurgeons. So they had a great marriage. They called it a marriage made in heaven. They loved each other dearly. There's a couple of books by, I can't remember the author's name right now. Ray Rhodes, is it Ray Rhodes? One's called Susie, I think, and it's just a biography of Susanna Spurgeon. But there's another one that's it's the untold love story of Charles and Susanna Spurgeon. So if you're sick of reading your Amish romance novels or whatever, maybe you can buy that one. And whatever, you know, with Amish Fabio on the cover, you can instead switch over to Spurgeon. All right. So anyway, I'm real interested in both of those books, and we'll probably read those eventually, and they get really good reviews. They're supposed to be good. There's one other Spurgeon biography I'll mention really quickly that's just an interesting anecdote that we've not covered in the class about Spurgeon's correspondence with a runaway slave who went into ministry. It's called Steal Away Home. That's a book that kind of shows that relationship. That might be something some of you might be interested in at some point. Spurgeon was a staunch abolitionist and really helped this gentleman become a pastor who was a former slave, and developed a friendship with him. And there's a book called Steal Away Home that details that. All right, so by 1888, this is after the downgrade controversy, when Spurgeon's been embroiled in this theological debate in the Baptist Union. Spurgeon's sickness and ailings and everything else increases. His stress increases. The downgrade controversy increases his stature in the long run, but at the same time, it's sort of like his early days all over again, except that he's very sick, because in his early days, he had a lot of success and a lot of notoriety, but also a lot of heavy criticism. And then in his final days, that sort of happened again. So in the aftermath of the downgrade controversy. And like I said, there are men who thrive on conflict. Women too, I guess. It's sort of, has anybody seen that movie, has anybody seen 1918? Have you guys seen that movie? 1918, you know what I'm talking about? It's one shot the whole way through. There's a scene, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch is a character in this movie. There's a scene where they're talking about him. He's a British general, and they're trying to get this note to him to not go into a battle, I think, if I remember correctly. But nonetheless, somebody looks at these guys because they realize that it might be futile what they're trying to do with this guy. And I think the line is, some men just like to fight or something. Is that the line, Dave? Anyway, but you know, it's something like that. There are people who are just like to fight. I think the best soldiers are the ones who don't like war. You know, like the best leaders are the ones who don't like war. It's one of my, like, say, for example, I love, I'm a big Douglas MacArthur fan, and I love MacArthur's strategy in the Pacific. One of my favorite MacArthur quotes, he says, you know, Patton and those other guys in the European theater in World War II tended to do what it took, no matter what kind of sacrifice it took to win battles. That was their strategy more. So you think about some of the European conflicts in World War II that had these mass casualties. You did not have the same thing happening in the Pacific. And a lot of that's because of MacArthur's sort of will to lose as few people as possible, and his at first reluctant but eventual willingness to use airplanes to his advantage. He was really against that early on, but then saw the use of technology, ceased to be a Luddite, and used in the Pacific, used airplanes. Nonetheless, I'm digressing. So the point that I'm trying to make, though, is MacArthur says something like this: I will not gain by sacrifice what I can gain by strategy. You know, and I love that idea. And to me, that's a reflection of the kind of general I want to serve under. You know, not like your life's as expendable as long as we can do that, but we may die, but we're going to die being strategic and not just throwing bodies and stuff. And so a lot of people just love to fight. They just love the fight. They love the conflict. Some people are addicted to the conflict. Spurgeon did not like conflict. there are a lot of like modern Christian pastory types who like sort of LARP Spurgeon and think that he they think that he was a pugilist and a fighter because he stood up so strong in this controversy, in the downgrade controversy, but really it grieved him nearly to death to be involved in controversy. He hated it, and it weighed heavily on him. So this pronounced criticism, the loss of friendships, these things are weighing heavily on Spurgeon. And then, so by 1888, he's having to spend more and more time in Mentone, France. So because the warmer climate helped him with his breathing and helped his ailments and everything else, he would see marked improvement getting out of London. 19th century London was not a good place for health, you know. And so a lot of the impact of the Industrial Revolution and other things are happening during this time, and London's just not healthy. So he would go to the coast of France, to Mentone, and he would go there. So in 1888, he as his health is declining pretty precipitously. He's in Mentone, and to make matters worse, where he's supposed to be getting better, he has a fall down a stone staircase, and his personal secretary, or I think he kind of functioned like a valet, as the British would say, you know, who took good care of him, kind of talks about this. He, in descending the stairs, he placed the end of his cane on a smooth marble step. It slipped, and he fell headlong. And so his secretary tells this about the fall. And this includes a little Spurgeon quip that I like. So neither he nor his friends realized at first how much he was injured. In his descent, he turned a somersault. Now, Spurgeon's not a little guy at this point, okay? He turned a somersault. He shook some money out of his pocket into his boot, knocked out two teeth that he was glad to lose. And as he picked himself up, he smilingly told his alarmed companions that it was painless dentistry with money to boot. And so again, he was just a really funny guy, you know, and a joyful guy, even in his ailments and challenges. He wrote about this later to the church. My injuries are far greater than I supposed. It'll be some time before foot, mouth, head, and nerves can be right again. What a mercy that I was not smashed quite up. Another stone would have brought me to mine end. May I be spared to keep my own footing to the end, and let the downgraders know how terrible is a fall from the high places of the Lord's truth. Never, I don't know if you know this about pastors, but we never turn down an opportunity to preach. So he had to preach one last time, but he's not there. I can't imagine. I mean, I have a hard time being gone for a week. You know, like, just I don't know. It's just something feels weird about it. So I can't imagine. It's like the other day, I was thinking about budget season. We had a budget meeting, and they go great, but it's still just budget meetings. And you know, somebody, I was talking to somebody about retirement, and and they were just talking about what an adjustment it is to retirement. So I just started thinking about, what would it be like to be retired, you know? And I thought, man, I wouldn't have to go to budget committee meetings anymore. And then I thought, I wouldn't get to go to budget committee meetings, you know? What if they mess it up? So, without me there, I can't retire. So I can't imagine going months at a time without being able to address the congregation or preach to them or whatever. So I can see why he would do this kind of thing. So Spurgeon sends him this letter saying he's really having a hard time there in 1888. So during this time, though, when he is back in London, he is extremely reticent. So Spurgeon is a man, and I say to men here all the time, stubbornness can kill you. And so he refuses, when he's back, to act as if his life has changed at all, or his health is not the way it was. So he never turns down opportunities to go preach, to travel and preach. He makes very minimal adjustments to his schedule, so his busyness continues to increase, and his sickness continues to increase during this time. Not only does he have recurring bouts of gout, but he had Bright's disease, which is kidney disease. David, one of you doctors here could probably help. I've got scores of doctors here. So you tell me, I think Bright's disease would have been the way in the 19th century that we just talk about kidney failure in general. Right? Is that right? It's a set of symptoms. Yeah, that's what I think. It's my understanding, as I've done research, is that Bright's disease. Gosh, we got all kinds of doctors. So it's not an ear disease, though. I know that. It's my understanding that now that's just a collection of kidney symptoms that then would have been called Bright's disease, but now it probably would be broken down into what's causing the kidney failure more specifically. So it's just a description of a set of symptoms, essentially. So anyway, I'm not a doctor. I don't have much medical knowledge at all. But as I've tried to figure out exactly what Bright's disease is, it's certainly kidney failure. I don't think it's what's causing the kidney failure. It's a description of kidney failure, I think. So he's got Bright's disease. It's increasingly doing this. Because of the kidney issues, he stays swollen regularly, and he's just not in good health, in really poor health. Then you add to that, the ministry needs of the tabernacle are not decreasing at all. The church continues to grow, even in his absence. It just continues to take a lot out of him. So during these intervening years between Spurgeon's downgrade controversy years and his death, you just have increasing busyness, increasing sickness, ministry needs growing, and then also the lingering criticism in the aftermath of the downgrade that's just, it made his final years difficult and hard. He falls in Mentone in 1888, and his time in Mentone continues to increase over time. One time when he's back in London, his deacons encourage him to not do any more outside ministry, and he doesn't quite listen, and he just won't slow it down. You know, finally he starts to slow down just a little bit, and starts to bring things down just a little bit, until June 7th, 1891, Spurgeon preaches his last sermon at the Metropolitan Tabernacle. So he preaches for the last time, and then for the next several months, he's bedridden, basically. He's too sick to leave the house. He stays sick. And then they realize he really needs to go to Mentone. So in October of 1891, Spurgeon went to Mentone for the winter. And initially he sees some improvement, but things just kind of keep getting worse. So these years of intense ministry, the late controversies in which he was embroiled, and the nagging realities of poor health finally took their toll on Spurgeon. On January 17th of 1892, in January that year, he preached one time to a small chapel there in Mentone. People had gathered around to hear him preach. He didn't preach. The one benefit of being in Mentone is that most people speak French. And one thing I know about the French is they speak French, you know. And they don't really, especially at this point, you didn't have a lot of people in France who were pressing him to come preach. Not as many people knew English here on the French coast. So he didn't have to preach a lot, but a lot of expatriates come together. He preaches one last time in January. And then finally, on January 17th, 1891, Spurgeon called out the hymn in a small service, and that was the end of his ministry. It was the last thing he did for the Lord, was just this really meager thing. In January of 1892, he passed away in Mentone, France. And then by the time his casket made it to London, just in London, at least 50,000 people paid their respects to Spurgeon. I mean, it was just this huge public outpouring of love and respect and admiration. There were services in Mentone, services back in London. It was a huge deal when Spurgeon died. After he died, all the newspapers, they were covered up with news of Spurgeon's death. He was literally a celebrity in his age. So you think about, this is important. I'm in ministry. It's important for me to remember. I can remember when I was in seminary, one of my favorite professors, his name's Herschel York. He's preached here. You guys may remember Dr. York. He's my supervisor in the doctoral program now as well. So love Dr. York, and he told us a story. He would always try to get us to make sure that we loved our families and did what we're supposed to do with our families and everything else. And he said one time he was at some sort of a minister's meeting, and an African-American gentleman spoke. And he said, "Boys, one of these days, y'all are going to die. And they're going to put you down there in the graveyard, and they're going to come back up to the church fellowship hall and eat potato salad." And he said, "So you need to just remember to focus on the people that are going to cry that day, you know." And I think about Spurgeon a lot, and I think about that. I think about the potato salad quote a lot anyway, and I think, you know, that's true. One day, I have all these, you know, I mean, I'm doing this and doing that and doing this and doing that, but one day, you know, have the funeral, and somebody's going to go back to the fellowship hall and eat potato salad. And then somebody's going to say, I wonder who's going to preach Sunday, you know? And that's okay. I'm happy to be there. Same with Spurgeon. He's easy to lionize. Man, I hope by the time we're done with this class, you get a sense of why we've studied him. I'm guessing most of you have been impressed by his ministry, impressed by his abilities, all these different things. As you think about it, after years of grand eloquence and amazingly prodigious work and unbelievable outsized influence in life, Spurgeon was totally unconscious and unable to give any parting words to the loved ones gathered around him as he died. Now, let me say this about pastors and preachers as well. We are a morbid lot, okay, because this is the work we do. You know, so I do a lot of funerals. You know, they're sad, it's hard, but at the same time, it's the work I do, right? So I think about funerals a lot. I think about things like this. I think about how I'd want to be remembered. We're morbid, and so we think a lot about things like last words. And Spurgeon even wrote some about what his last words would be. You know, he talked a lot about how he would leave this world. He died at 57 years old. He knew he wasn't going to live to be old because he had such profound health issues. And so he thought a lot about his own death. It shows you, though, even the greatest among us doesn't get to choose how they leave, right? And so he was semi-comatose, basically not able to speak, not able to talk by the time he died. And so I think there's a temptation to see in ourselves and to see, especially in someone like Spurgeon, a nearly superhuman existence, you know? And I think we think sometimes that, you know, the greatest Christians, this is the greatest Christians would die with all this nobility and grace and all this kind of thing. But we don't choose how we go. We don't choose how we go. And it's no sign of the greatness of your life, how you go to be with the Lord. And even Spurgeon, I think a lot about Spurgeon. And I think a lot about his death. And I think a lot about the way that the Lord used his weakness. We think so much about his gifts, but God beset him with weaknesses and depression and struggles. Here's what he said to his students, and I think this quote well reflects Spurgeon's own death. He says, "There may be here and there men of iron to whom wear and tear work no perceptible detriment, but surely the rust frets even these. And as for ordinary men, the Lord knows and makes them to know that they are but dust." And you think about the Prince of Preachers, maybe the greatest preacher that's ever lived, you know? I've never heard anybody claim someone better. You know, I don't know anyone now who we would put, I couldn't shine Spurgeon's shoe. I couldn't black his boots, as he would say, you know? And he died humbly. He died sadly. He didn't go out preaching. He went out silent. He didn't go out, you know, this is months and months after his last time he was able to even address his own congregation that he went to be with the Lord. And so surely it's a reminder for all of us, I think, several things I think about in Spurgeon's life and death. One, let me just say a few things about it. One, suffering and weakness are not signs of a lack of faith or a lack of usefulness for the Lord, right? In fact, oftentimes they're signs of greater usefulness for the Lord. And I think a lot of us read about Spurgeon, we think, man, what would he have done if he hadn't been so sick, you know? I don't know. I don't want to know, though, right? I don't want to know what a set of gifts like this would look without the same set of weaknesses that Spurgeon had. It's good to be reminded that we're not, like he said, surely the rust frets even men of iron, you know? They can keep on doing the work, but surely gets them, and certainly we see that with Spurgeon. So that's one thing, you know, Spurgeon's life is a sign of the way that God uses weak things in the world to shame our wisdom. Another thing I'll say is that mental challenges, mental struggles, mental illness is not a sign of a lack of faith or a lack of trust in the Lord. Because one of Spurgeon's greatest weaknesses was his challenges and depression. And we've had different folks throughout this class talk about how they were encouraged by the fact Spurgeon struggled. And then we've had other people say, understandably, that they wouldn't have ever dreamed any pastor struggled with that kind of stuff, right? Well, because, you know, I mean, you don't, nobody wants the pastor to get up every Sunday and be like, phew, really down today, guys. You know, I mean, that's just not what people are looking for on Sunday mornings. I'm not afraid to say that if I am. But we're there to declare the word of the Lord, you know. And so those kinds of weaknesses are not signs of a lack of faith or a sign that the Lord's not using you or that you're doing something wrong. Things are normal. And the Lord doesn't have, another professor of mine always said, God doesn't spoil his children. You know, he loves them and treats them well, but he doesn't spoil them. And so many of us are beset by these things. The last thing I'll just say about Spurgeon's legacy in life in terms of the way he died and everything else is that his challenges and struggles ought to humble us, I think. And it ought to be a reminder to us in all of our lives. The reality is, and I'm a young man, so maybe some of y'all are going to laugh at me when I say this, but there's a sense in which a lot of us tend to, at least myself, I don't often think about my own mortality very often. You know, now some of y'all might need a dose of not thinking about your own mortality. I don't know. Y'all might be morbid or something. But I don't think a lot about the fact I'm going to die, you know? Like, I just don't think about it very often. But being reminded of the way Spurgeon died and his health challenges, we live in an age where there are health challenges, but they're not as widespread and they're not as pronounced as they were, but by God's grace, in 19th century London. But at the same time, and I think some about, like, just what COVID's done for our high view of ourselves, you know, and how great and wonderful and smart we are, you know, and then a virus shuts everything down for a couple of years or whatever. And I think when we see weakness like this, it's a good reminder that we are but dust, you know, and to dust we shall return. And the modern age is disconnected from suffering in lots of ways that previous ages weren't. From our own health and our tendency to be healthy. And I'm not trying to downplay suffering any of you have experienced. Don't mishear me. But still, if we get sick, it's still the worst sickness we can get. Still different than how people would have suffered even 100 years ago in almost every sort of way. I think a lot about, you know, I leave hospital visits sometimes and think, you know, they wouldn't have been alive 100 years ago. You know what I mean? And God's been so good to us. You go all the way from our own health to, like, our disconnect from what it takes to eat. You know? Like, our great-great-grandparents, if they wanted meat, they killed their meat and ate it, you know, or had to at least have some connection to that. And we go to the Publix and it looks like a box of cereal almost. You know what I mean? Like, and my kids see it and they're like, oh, that's gross. But it's just a little cellophane package. You don't have to think about that. So we're among the most unique generations in human history in the sense that we are so disconnected from survival and the means of survival and the rawness of the fall. We've experienced it in other ways, don't mishear me, but still we're disconnected. So I hope you'll take suffering like Spurgeon's and the rawness of what he experienced and what he went through and just allow it to humble you and help you reflect on your own weakness and frailty and be reminded. You know, it's just funny to me, there's such a, like, hyper-scientism in the world today. And I'm pro-science, man. Listen, like, doctor me up. You know what I mean? Like, I want the best I can get. So don't mishear me. But there is, like, a sort of hyper sort of view of almost like a hyper-positivity about our abilities as humans, and a disconnect from suffering in so many ways. And I hope that seeing the way people suffered in the past will remind us that we still live in the same fallen world they lived in. And there are lots of graces that God's given us in the modern age, but we can't miss the humility of remembering we are not God, and we are not gods, and we are not superhumans, that we're frail and we're mortals. And it's a good reminder. So when I read about Spurgeon, I'm just reminded of that I have feet of clay, and that to dust I will return. So Spurgeon's final, God, fourth thing, you never arrive. You never arrive, you know? You're not guaranteed anything. And you think about just the mightiness of Spurgeon and all that he accomplished and all that he did, and you would think he was kind of owed cruising in on his last days, you know? And I think about that sometimes, you know? Like, been here 10 years, you know, or whatever, and, you know, it's I'm owed this or I'm owed that. Well, God doesn't owe us anything. You know, God doesn't owe us anything. And Spurgeon was criticized probably more harshly in his last days than he was in his earliest days. He never arrived, you know? And I think it's a good reminder for all of us that we never arrive. At least I need to be reminded of that regularly. You never arrive. You never know what's around the next corner. But you can see the way that Spurgeon expressed faith in the Lord even in his most pronounced sufferings. And in his wife's sufferings, his lifelong sufferings, all these things. And I hope that his example will help spur you on to faith and good works in the on your own sufferings that all of us will inevitably experience. We'll all suffer in some way. And so I hope he'll inspire you to trust the Lord and to remember that, you know, God doesn't owe you anything. He didn't owe Spurgeon anything, that's for sure. I'll say it like this. I'm struck as I read about his last days. There's a sadness that comes over me. And I think, you know, he didn't even get to retire. You know what I mean? He didn't even get to enjoy the fruit of his labors in his last days. He didn't get to sit back and enjoy what God had done at the tabernacle. He was fighting and struggling till his last days. And then that's a good reminder for me, you know, that the Lord doesn't owe me anything in this life. And he's given me everything in the next one. And that's where I want to put my hope and trust. And I hope you'll be led in similar directions. Are there any questions? We'll probably be able to finish up a little early, but I'll open up for questions. Are there any questions about Spurgeon's final days or thoughts, things you're reflecting on as you think about the way Spurgeon went to be with the Lord?
You said you didn't think much about death.
Right.
And you're too young. You get up in your high 80s and you think about it quite a bit.
Think about it a little more?
Yes.
How should we handle that, Ted?
A Bible and a bad young fellow.
He said a Bible and a Valium helps. So, we need to get that printed up on a t-shirt, you know, a Bible and a Valium helps. Hey, we're thankful for medicine, but we trust the Lord, right, Ted? That's it. I'm with you. Man, that's true. I think about it more now than I did 10 years ago, but I'm sure 10 years from now it'll be even more pronounced. Any other?
The nursing home.
Do what?
The great fear is the nursing home.
That's your great fear, yeah.
That puts you into a depression right there.
Any other thoughts or anything else to share or think about in this? Any questions?
I have one question, not on his last day.
Sure, anything.
Kind of, you know, you talked about he wasn't looking for a fight, but he was really convicted about what he was convicted for. You know,
right,
convicted
yes.
For, and he didn't mind calling someone out. He had real strong thoughts about baptism.
Right.
You know, and fought against paedo-baptism and stuff like
yeah.
that. Did he ever address the people that he really seemed to look up to that all seemed to be practitioners of it, whether it's Calvin, the Puritan,
yeah.
Augustine,
yeah.
Luther. I mean,
obviously, his own grandfather and father were both paedo-baptists.
Yeah.
So they were Congregationalists. So it's a real challenge for Spurgeon. I think he became a really staunch biblicist, right? So he just became a very staunch biblicist in the sense, like, if it's not in the Bible, I'm not doing it kind of thing, you know? So he did address that. I think his major concern and his real dividing line was not so much paedo-baptism versus believer's baptism, which it was a dividing line for him, but where he really reserved his harshest criticism was for baptismal regeneration, which is the idea that a baby is regenerated through the practice of baptism. That's what he reserved his harshest criticism for. And what he said was a lot of the evangelical paedo-baptists of his day, who he knew didn't believe that, didn't draw hard enough distinctions between themselves and, especially in the Anglican fellowship, right? The group that was trying to become a little, they're trying to cozy more up with Roman Catholicism, the Tractarians, which was kind of a long British 19th century movement, you know, the Tractarians. and they're trying to move back toward Catholicism. Spurgeon said that people like Ryle, I think it was the baptismal regeneration controversy. Nettles talks about it a little bit, and he preached against it and basically called like Ryle and others out, the more evangelical Anglicans, for not making enough distance from those who believed in something like baptismal regeneration. So I think that's the biggest that I'm aware of. That's the biggest way he addressed it. Of course, if you read when he became a Baptist, it was actually an Anglican chaplain that convinced him to be a Baptist, because the Anglican was trying to convince him to not be a Congregationalist, but to be an Anglican. And what's it called when someone vouches for your baptism? A sponsor. So the Anglican's trying to convince him of sponsorship, right? And he says, "Don't." And so the Anglican priest says to Spurgeon when he's at school, he says, "Don't you believe that the Bible teaches that it ought to be repentance and faith before you're baptized?" And he's like, "Yeah, I do." So he says, "Well, don't you think you ought to have a sponsor for it?" And he said, so Spurgeon goes to defend his father and grandfather, you know, his family's religious tradition. He goes to try to prove this Anglican wrong. And he comes back and he says, "No, you're right. It's in the Bible." And the guy says, "So don't you think you should be baptized, you know, with a sponsor?" He says, "No, I'm sure the next time I do it, I'll do it on my own faith," you know, or whatever is what he says. So that's kind of how he becomes convinced of it. But interestingly enough, before he was baptized as a young man, he wrote for permission from his father to be baptized before he was baptized. So he was still very respectful of his father. And in fact, in later years, his father preached at the tabernacle often. So he was not a pugilist, or he didn't write those people off. In fact, it was a Presbyterian in his waning days, in one of these periods in Mentone, it was a Presbyterian who filled the pulpit the whole time at the tabernacle. So he still shared fellowship with those folks and loved them. So again, this is a balance we all wrestle with, right? And struggle with doctrinally, which is like, where do we draw the lines? You know, and I think Spurgeon tried to be really warm-hearted, but his hard line was really drawn at how you viewed paedobaptism versus the simple practice of it. Does that make any sense? And that's probably where I am too. And let me just say, like, so for example, you know, we wrestle with it. Every Baptist has to wrestle with this, you know. I mean, it's in the name. You know what I mean? It's like, if you don't, can't be a Baptist if you don't wrestle with this stuff. But we're constantly, and Spurgeon was constantly thinking through, you know, how to. It's a little easier in his day because church was so popular, you know. But I think a lot about, you know, if I was in Saudi Arabia, you know, and I was the only evangelical church in 100 miles, what would my view be the same on these things? I don't know, you know. I'm not in Saudi Arabia. So we have to wrestle with that. But that was his hard line. And of course, he held his father and grandfather in the highest esteem through his whole life, wrote about them regularly, his love for them, and invited paedobaptists to preach at the tabernacle regularly as well. Does that answer your question at all, Paul? That's from my limited scope of knowledge. I've not read through all the material with an eye for that, but that's what I've seen. The story's funny. I think it's told most clearly in Dalimore. What's the big one? The Baptist guy wrote it. Louis Drummond's the story of his becoming a Baptist, being convinced of believer's baptism, you know, baptism after faith, credo baptism. It's a funny story how he kind of quips back with this priest, you know. Now, I will say all his biographers love to demonstrate him as very precocious, as a child prodigy kind of thing. So it might be embellished a little bit, but it's still a funny story. All right, any other thoughts or questions? It's a false alarm back there. I thought Whitney had a question, but she was just... Yeah, I just saw movement, and I was like, here comes another one, but no. You know, got excited for a second. Well, anything else? Well, if we're late next week, it's because business meeting's going on. Everyone's welcome to business meeting. It should be a good, joyful one. We discuss our budget for next year, and but we'll come down here and just be thinking about... Maybe I think we might talk about Spurgeon's impact on the world and everything else, but I'd love to hear maybe his impact on you. And I've been encouraged by the different comments and things I've heard, and I know everyone else would be as well. So I won't put anybody on the spot or anything, but you know, if you have any thoughts, Everyone here would love to hear someone but me talk. So we'll, when we get that going. All right, let me pray for us. And if you got other questions, I'll be around. I've got a few minutes before I go to a budget meeting. So let's pray. God, we thank you so much for Jesus. We thank you for the grace that you've given to us. God, we thank you for the grace that we can see in church history. And Father, it's my prayer and my desire, God, that our hearts and lives will be changed by your word, but as we see a model of someone who followed your word. So in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.